persons who are on behalf of God.
You've got to institute these practical material designations. Even Lord Chaitanya's immediate associates, they weren't Babaji's. This began with Rupa and Sanatana. But the devotees who were sent to Vrindavan, they started practicing as Paramahamsas. But in Navadvipa, in the early part of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, most of his devotees were grihasthas. And then later he went to Puri, and some of his followers, and some of his associates were sannyasis. But they were all, these grihasthas, sannyasis, they were all following the Varnashram system. But what was different than the situation then, and our modern situation, is that the ancient system was still intact 500 years ago. The society, Bengali society, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu descended into, was a society that still had functioning the divisions of the four varnas and the four rashtras. People understood. The infrastructure was there. Just like you go to New York City, it's expected, you turn the tap, water comes on. You push the switch, light comes on. In America, you don't expect that the light's going to be on for 8 hours a day, like here in India, or that the water will run out. It would create panic. In New York City, if the lights went out for 5 minutes, or the water went out, there would be a revolution. That infrastructure is there, it's in place. Of course, someday it may disappear. But people assume the presence of the infrastructure, the electric system, the light system, the water, everything is being provided. You don't even think about it. So 500 years ago in Bengal, at the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, with his hundreds of devotees, this ancient Vedic system, that infrastructure was still in place. Just like we don't think about where to get, how to get electricity and water, it just comes in the West. Like that, in Bengal 500 years ago, everybody knew what a Brahmin was, and what a Brahmin was expected to do, and how you deal with a Brahmin, and what a sannyasi is, and how to be a sannyasi, and how you deal with a sannyasi, and the proper behavior for a grihastha, and a brahmachari. These things were just common knowledge, and it was all being practiced. But then, very soon after that, after the disappearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Kali Yuga progressed, and the Vedic system fell apart. And all the vestiges that remained were just corrupt. Brahmins who neglected to do any duty except for accept charity. Brahma Bhojana is the only thing they can remember. They want to take charity, but they weren't not giving anything in exchange for it. And sannyasis who were living like grihasthas. Grihasthas who were begging like sannyasis. Everything upside down. This is the modern remnant of the Varnashram system. But nothing, the infrastructure is ruined. It's like India. Okay, you've got the electric switch, but you push the button, nothing happens. You turn the tap, nothing comes out. So we have the external shell of the Varnashram system, but everything's ruined. Therefore, without the infrastructure, it's very difficult to peacefully prosecute Krishna consciousness. If you're not a Paramahamsa, things are very difficult. Without that infrastructure, without that support of the social system. It was there 500 years ago. So Lord Chaitanya could easily perform the pastimes of a son of the Brahmin family. Go to school and become a pundit. Can't do that anymore. Where's the proper school to go to become a proper Vaishnava pundit? There isn't no such thing. How can you be a sannyasi? You go begging, you'll get arrested. Or people will kick you in the face. So the infrastructure's gone. You can't peacefully follow the ancient system, even if you try to. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and Prabhupada have the vision that it has to be reinstituted. Without this infrastructure, most people can't make much progress in Krishna consciousness. Only a few can become Paramahamsas, but most people are not going to be able to make much progress. Just like Krishna says in the Gita, Maiva mana arhatsva mai buddha niveshaya. My first recommendation, Arjuna, just think about me 24 hours a day. Just fix your intelligence on me completely. My mami veshesha samsayaha, and I promise you will come to me without a doubt, very quickly. Why not do that? But then Krishna understands, okay, Arjuna, maybe you're not ready for that. Maybe you can't surrender yourself immediately, fully. Maybe your mind is not strong enough. Maybe you're distracted by material desires, and you can't think about me clearly 24 hours a day. Okay. Atai shatos. If you can't remember me 24 hours a day, abhyasa yogena tato mamu ichap tum dananjaya. Then, if you can't practice raganuga bhakti, if you can't just spontaneously be thinking of me all the time, then practice sadhana bhakti at least. Now follow the rules and regulations. If you don't have spontaneous attraction, then do the right thing out of a sense of duty. Listen to your spiritual master, take his instructions seriously, listen to the instructions of the scripture, of the shastra, and don't disobey them. Then you'll also become purified gradually. It'll take a little more time. The desire, that spontaneous desire will gradually awaken in your heart if you follow the rules and regulations of sadhana bhakti. So Krishna's first recommendation is spontaneous, pure Krishna consciousness. Just think about him all the time. The second recommendation for those who can't do that, aren't ready to do that, is practice sadhana bhakti. Follow devotional service by the rules and regulations given by spiritual master and scriptures. But Krishna gives a few more recommendations after that. Okay, abhyasya abhyasma asamartosi. If you can't even follow sadhana bhakti, mat karma paramo bhava, then work for me. That will purify you. That is the karmakanda process. Okay, you can't even, you're not even ready for pure devotional service. You can't really be convinced that Krishna is the supreme person, that the supreme is a person, that the purpose of our life is just to satisfy Krishna. You've got so many desires, you can't think about satisfying God, you can only think about how to satisfy yourself. But you have an understanding that God is there, that he's the supreme controller. Okay, then do whatever you're going to do anyway. Practice your prescribed duty according to your desires and your propensities. But give the results, offer the results to God. That's like the karmakanda process. A person has his material desires, but in order to fulfill his material desires, he performs sacrifice. Yagyartat karma nonyatra loko yam karma bandhana. You can avoid entanglement of material attachment if you do your work for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord. Offer the fruit to him. So the Vedic Varnashram system is built around this attempt to do sacrifice, to offer the results of one's work to Vishnu. Especially the Brahmins, their business is to perform sacrifice for themselves and on behalf of the rest of the people of society, to engage everybody in doing sacrifice for Vishnu. So this basic division of Brahmins and Kshatriyas, this is the essential foundation of this social system. The Vaishyas and the Shudras, although they're the majority of the population, there are many more Shudras than anything else, and then there are a lot of businessmen, and then there are a few real Kshatriyas, and even less Brahmins. Maybe Brahmins are 1/10 of the population, according to Manu's estimate. It varies. At different times in history, there are different percentages of each of the four varnas. But the Brahmins are by far the minority. But the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, even though they're numerically less, they're by far the most important members of society. If the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas do their prescribed, they fill their responsibilities, and especially if they work together cooperatively, then everything will be smooth for everybody else. But the Brahmins and Kshatriyas have to be separate. They have separate responsibilities, different privileges, different responsibilities. Just like traditional Vedic community, Brahmins would live separately. Kshatriyas live in their royal precincts, and the Brahmins would have their own part, own villages where they lived. Separation, physical separation. And the Brahmins have, you know, they try to live a simple life. Kshatriyas live a much more opulent life. So they have to stay separate. But still, they're very much involved in working together. If we don't separate out the two different functions of ruling, let's say ruling and teaching, the two basic functions, Kshatriyas are the managers of human beings, and the Brahmins are the thinkers and the teachers and the priests. If we don't separate these functions out, if we let the same person try to do both, there's chaos. Again, unless we have Paramahamsas. A great Paramahamsa, like Prabhupada, can do everything at once. But a person who is not a Paramahamsa, who is not perfect, who is not completely free from material attachment, he's going to have problems when he tries to function at the same time as a Brahmin and a Kshatriya, but to speak of also getting involved with money, becoming a Vaishya also. If you try to be all three, then there's trouble. So therefore, the traditional system is, even you may have so many different propensities built into you, you have to be one or the other. It's like you can ride, you have a bicycle with 15 gears, and you have to go up a hill. You can pick any of, you know, five or six different gears and get up the hill. But you got to pick one gear and stay in it. You got to make a choice. Like that, maybe you could be a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, you have the propensity for either one, but you got to pick one or the other and stick to it. Function in one role or the other. It has to be separated out, otherwise there's chaos. Or at least, human society cannot become very civilized when we don't properly distinguish these different functions of the rulers and the spiritual leaders. If it's not separated, then there's not proper smooth organization of society. It can't be a peaceful situation. Anyway, in the modern world we don't have. Basically, the infrastructure has been destroyed, and we don't have any real Brahmins and Kshatriyas available in society. You got people who claim they were born in Brahmin families, but their behavior and their consciousness is much below the standard. They're not real Brahmins. We don't want to be disrespectful. Krishna doesn't want to disrespect anybody who's a Brahmin, even if he's not up to the standard. So we show respect, but we have to understand they're not real Brahmins. It's Kali Yuga Brahmins. And there are no real Kshatriyas either. We have people, politicians, who can muster some power over other people by committing violence. But a Kshatriya is not just a tyrant or a thug. A real Kshatriya has to be a noble person. I'll ask a question, maybe some come up with the answer. What's the one characteristic that distinguishes the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas from everybody else? Now, what's the difference between either a Brahmin or Kshatriya on one hand and a Vaishya or Shudra on the other? Okay, well, he had his hand first. Do Brahmins rule? Kshatriyas rule. Brahmins try to avoid getting into rulership. So that would be a characteristic of a Kshatriya. But I'm asking, what's the characteristic of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas together as opposed to the others?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. But there's different concepts of dharma. So even the Vaishya, you know, he's got his dharma. My dharma is to make a lot of money and maintain my family, and I'm very devoted to that dharma. And Shudra's got his dharma. My dharma is to work real hard. Yes, okay. Well, okay, the idea I have, that's right. But the idea I have is that the prominent characteristic that distinguishes the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas from the lower classes is their mentality of selfless service. A Vaishya is out to take care of his family and make a lot of money. A Shudra is just, you know, taking care of his own body. But a Brahmin or a Kshatriya will sacrifice the interests of his own body, even his own family, for the interests of the whole society. He's selfless. A selfless servant of society. That characteristic is shared by the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas equally. There's just a difference of how they serve.
The Kshatriyas use violence to serve society, not selflessly. You know, they'll kill, they'll conquer for the service of society. But the Brahmanas are non-violent. They don't want to do that. So that's the difference between the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. But both of them are out to serve society, not themselves. And that means they're noble. They're well-educated human beings who have developed good qualities of selflessness. So that's desirable in human society, such noble, selfless persons. It would be best if we had Paramahamsas. Even one or two Paramahamsas can change the world. A person who's purely Krishna, who has actually love of God, he doesn't need to pay attention to karma-kanda distinctions. Can act like a Paramahamsa, like an Avaduta. And just by his personal example and his personal influence, he'll liberate many people and give them love of God. But when you don't have such Paramahamsas easily available, the next best thing is to develop Brahminical culture and let the Brahmins train up proper Kshatriyas to manage society. And then when you have the symbiosis, the cooperation between Brahmins and Kshatriyas, then human society can be civilized, peaceful, and progressive. Yeah. It's not a solution to make rubber stamp Paramahamsas, imitation Paramahamsas. They won't save the world. And that's why, first the Gaudiya Mutt and then ISKCON, we have these ashram distinctions. And that's why Prabhupada wants us also to institute the Varna distinctions, gradually. That's Prabhupada's unfinished mission. Okay. Let's run schedule here. Let's look at Kardama Muni. Let's actually look at the first couple of verses here. This is the first verse. Let's start from verse 6. Okay, the homework assignment is going to be to read these two chapters. This is your homework for the 2 weeks. Read the two chapters, chapters Canto 3, chapter 21 and 22. Who has books of their own? 2, 3, 4. 4 or 5? 4, okay. Okay, for everybody else, we're going to provide printouts. Read in the computer, okay. Okay. Well, then you have to bring the computer. Anybody else have a copy in their computer? The Dharma Town Folio? You do. Okay, so we have, say, 5 that don't need printouts. And we're going to try by tomorrow to provide the printouts of those two chapters. We're going to start looking at today, beginning with verse 6 of verse 6 of chapter 21 of the third canto. Let's see. I'll tell you each day how much you should read by the next day, or ask me if I don't tell you. Like, today we're going to cover through verse 9 of chapter 21. Pretty much ignoring the first 5 verses. So from verse 6 to 9. And then for tomorrow, from verse 12, 15, up to say 16 or 17. 12 to 17 of chapter 21. You should read that by tomorrow. Although we don't have the sheets yet. Theoretically you should read those verses. I'll try to arrange that by 11 o'clock tomorrow. Those printouts will be available here downstairs in the office. Anybody wants to pick them up. Otherwise, I'll bring the copies to class. Okay, so in verse 6, let's look at verse 6 here. Let's go back to verse 1 for a minute. Text 1 of chapter 21. This is interesting. Vidura asks Maitreya, "The line of Swayambhu Manu was most esteemed. O worshipable sage, I beg you, give me an account of this race whose progeny multiplied through sexual intercourse." So he's specifically asking, let me hear about how the world was populated by sexual intercourse. Anyway, we discussed why that's relevant to the purposes of the Bhagavatam. This is fulfilling the creation of the universe, the pastime of Lord Vishnu and Brahma and his sons, to populate the universe as one of God's pastimes. And especially in the dynasties of the moon and sun god, great devotees and the Supreme Lord himself will take birth. So therefore this topic is relative, relevant. Jumping ahead to verse 6. The great sage Maitreya, this is verse 6 in chapter 21. The great sage Maitreya replied, commanded by Lord Brahma to beget children in the worlds, the worshipable Kartava Muni practiced penance on the bank of the river Saraswati for a period of 10,000 years. Now the first point here is that Lord Brahma commanded Kartava to have children, to help populate the world. So we can't blame him completely for trying to find a wife. He was asked to do that by Lord Brahma, his father. Now Brahma himself was celibate, but it was his responsibility to get this world populated. He had to arrange it. So he was in anxiety, although he's not going to get involved in having children. He's got to ask his sons to please get married and have children. Now Kartava, okay, he's receiving an order. He can say, well, it's not my fault, I was told to do it. But on the other hand, he must have had some material desire. Prabhupada explains you're allowed to refuse the request, the order of the spiritual master to get married. He could have refused, as the four Kumaris did. So it's also his own fault. He also has material desire. But look what he does. On the order of his father, on the order of Brahma, the creator of the world, he performs very strict austerities for 10,000 years. That means, first of all, he's not without ambition. He has this material desire. But he's ready to do the necessary, the proper thing to fulfill his desire according to the rules and regulations of the Vedas. So he's a typical Brahmin, very pure Brahmin, not a mixed half Brahmin, half Kshatriya. He's a real Brahmin. But we can see a Brahmin, even the purest Brahmin, he's not without ambition. He's not without determination. He's not a weak person. Not a person without strong desires. But the Brahmin's potency is very subtle. The way that he goes about fulfilling his desire and carrying out his ambitions and exercising his determination is very brahminical. It's very much in the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness is not completely static and indifferent. Read on a little bit, going to verse 7, 8, and 9. Description by Maitreya Muni about what Kartava did. After receiving the order of Brahma to beget children and performing penances for 10,000 years. Next verse 7 says, during that period of penance, the sage Kartava, by worship through devotional service in trance, propitiated the personality of Godhead, who is the quick bestower of all blessings upon those who flee to him for protection. So he's not only meditating, but he's got the good sense to engage in devotional service, use his meditation for devotional service. My understanding is that he's not performing shuddha bhakti, not performing pure devotional service according to our standard. This is kriya yoga, or karma mishra bhakti is what he's practicing. He's got material desires. He's got a material program to carry out. Even though it's Brahma's order, still it's material work. It's fulfilling his own material desire. But he's meditating on Vishnu as the means to carry out that desire. That's what we call karma mishra bhakti. Motivation is material, fruit of work, motivation. But you're worshipping Vishnu to carry out, fulfill that desire. And we read in the next verse, what he accomplished by that meditation on Lord Vishnu for 10,000 years. Verse 8. Let me just jump over here. Text 8. Then, in the Satya Yuga, the lotus-eyed Supreme Personality of Godhead, being pleased, showed himself to that Kartava Muni and displayed his transcendental form, which can be understood only through the Vedas. So by practicing not pure but mixed devotional service, with the material desires, still Lord Vishnu was pleased with Kartava and showed himself. This shows that Kartava is a very elevated soul, Vishnu doesn't show himself to just anybody. It's a rare person who gets his desires directly fulfilled by Vishnu. Vishnu can withhold, you know, he's not Ashutosh like Lord Shiva. He can not give what the devotees ask. But not only is he giving Kardama what he's asking for, he came personally to promise that. Why did he show himself? That says in the stated in the verse we just read, he was pleased with Kardama. This wasn't some mechanical process. Vishnu was not forced, you know, the sacrifice was performed, therefore the demigod has to give the result. No. He was satisfied, and he personally decided, okay, I want to show myself to Kardama. Not some mechanical method. And it says that the words are Shabdam Brahma Vabuhu. He showed his form that is understood only through the Vedas, the Shabda Brahma. That means that this particular vision that Kardama received of God is not something concoction out of his head, not some hallucination. He's not just some crazed person who thinks he sees God. This is God actually revealing himself. The same God who's described in the Vedas, the perfect description of the Vedas. Same revelation was given to Kardama Muni by the Lord's own desire, his own pleasure. Okay, next verse, verse 9, describes what Kardama saw. I'll read the verse. Kardama Muni saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is free from material contamination, effulgent like the sun, wearing a garland of white lotuses and water lilies. The Lord was clad in spotless yellow silk, and his lotus face was fringed with slick, dark locks of curling hair. I'll read the next two verses, continuing the description of the beauty of Lord Vishnu. Adorned with a crown and earrings, he held his characteristic conch, disc, and mace in three of his hands and a white lily in the fourth. He glanced about in a happy, smiling mood whose sight captivates the hearts of all devotees. A golden streak on his chest, the famous Kaustubha gem suspended from his neck, he stood in the air with his lotus feet placed on the shoulders of Garuda. Okay, so that's what Kardama saw. All attractive personal features of the Lord. And he saw not some personal whimsical idea of what God looks like, but this is the standard description of Vishnu. Vishnu always looks like this. The descriptions always say that he has this jewel and this garland, and his weapons, and he's riding on Garuda. It's all very standard Vedic description, not some mental wild concoction out of his own head. Okay, anyway, that's basically the end of today's discussion. We'll continue tomorrow from verse 12 of the prayers that Kardama Muni offers to Lord Vishnu, and we'll do some analysis of how what Kardama says to Vishnu gives us some hints about what kind of political personality he has, what the character of a Brahmin. Okay. We have a few minutes, like 6 minutes, if anybody has any questions. But first, one thing I should do is get everybody's names written down who's attending. Is that your name? Your kind of name? Can you use a couple of papers? Maybe just pass it around and have everybody sign their name. I didn't get an attendance sheet. Maybe just use the pad and pass it around. Yes, please.
In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it says the Satyuga is the
and yeah. Even among the demigods, actually, there's division. Some of the demigods are considered Brahmins, and some of them are considered Kshatriyas and even Vaishyas and Shudras.
They don't even, yeah.
So this is more subtle. You know, the widespread, strict division of human society was not in place in Satyuga. Yeah. It's just that at this point, even at the beginning of Satyuga, the social system is beginning to develop. Here we've got one of the very few functioning Brahmins in the world. There's only a couple of rishis. Yeah, we're 5 minutes, then we're done. At this point, at the beginning of Brahma's day, there's only a couple of Prajapatis. The universe is almost unpopulated anyway, so how many Brahmins do you have? You only got one Kshatriya at this point. So just the beginning of the seed of the development of the social system. And it's mostly undeveloped in Satyayuga. Even the Vedic process of sacrifice is not developed in Satyayuga. It's only in Tretayuga that the Vedic fire sacrifice system starts to be manifest. Mostly in Satyayuga, everybody sits around and meditates. Like on, you know, as if you went up to Tapaloka, you know, where everybody sits around and meditates all the time. The earth was like that in Satyayuga. You know, Kardama means dirt. He wasn't a dirty person. I don't know why he has that name. There could be some other meaning I'm not familiar with. He considered himself contaminated. He was embarrassed. You know, he has to go to Vishnu and ask for a wife. You know, go to God and say, can you help me find a wife? He felt dirty. So maybe that's more of his own conception of himself. Give me 1 second. I'll check the dictionary and see if it says anything about Kardama. 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 Mud. This is Monia Williams' Sanskrit dictionary. Yeah. Kardama means mud, slime, mire, clay, dirt, filth. Sin. Name of a Prajapati, born from the shadow of Brahma, husband of Devahuti and father of Kapila. Anyway, it means dirt, mud. Anyway, to be born in the material world is a dirty thing. It's an embarrassing situation. It's an embarrassment. Yes, I think we all have experience of that. Yeah. Here we're sitting in this. Yes. But we'll see. This person, Kardama, he handled himself pretty good. Okay, it's embarrassing to be in the material, but he made the best of a bad bargain. And he went back to Godhead. Yes, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. Ramanuja, have you had something else? You want to add something? Okay.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, in those days, what kind of a body did he have? Was this on the earth?
It's said that Swayambhuva was the king of the earth, yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, Navadvip and Vrindavan are not material places. They don't conform to the limits of time and space. You know, everybody has to sign it. And in the next 3 minutes. Go ahead. Give the paper to everybody, okay? You pass it. Give everybody so everybody can sign it. You have to sign it now. Please give everybody. Because we want to put everybody's name on the list, okay? Take the list. But quickly, and then give it to everybody. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, he's playing with it. Yeah. Kri didn't come as a toy, so he's holding it like a toy. It's like a king, you know, he's just got a lotus and just, you know, playing around with it. Yeah, twirling it around, yeah. Yeah, just, you know, pick up a lotus and enjoy just playing around with it. Yes?
From that, I heard it right. You said that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote a letter in 1912.
Yes.
To Bhaktisiddhanta.
He gave some specific instructions, and he told them that it's your responsibility to help reinstitute this Daivi Varnashram. I'm telling you, please do this. One of the other things he emphasized in the letter was the development of the glorious Sri Ramayana. Then he also added this.
It was before the beginning of the
movement. Yes, before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati took sannyas and established the movement.
Another question is, you said that even the associates of Lord Chaitanya were not Babaji's.
Also the Lord Hostels.
And what's the specific reason why you got Sanatana to that particular standard? Well, there was like a reconstruction of Lord Chaitanya?
Yes. they, Rupa and Sanatan and their followers and the other Goswamis of Vrindavan, are showing the world how to worship Krishna in the extreme mood of separation as practiced by the gopis. It's not to be imitated. This is the perfection of pure devotional service. It's that mood of viraha bhava of the Vraja gopis. Because they are intimate associates of Srimati Radharani, Rupa, Sanatan, and the Goswamis. And practically that means, at this time and place, to go to Vrindavan and give everything up. And just constantly hear, chant, and remember Krishna, about Krishna, Radha, and Krishna's pastimes. That means forget about eating and sleeping, forget about all social connections, everything, drop everything. And just go and worship Radha, Krishna, and Vrindavan. So specifically, they went to Vrindavan to act like this. They weren't sitting in Calcutta or someplace. That was, you know, that was his order for some, for those few devotees, not for all of his associates. We're also meant to practice the same worship of Radha and Krishna, but through the path of sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti will awaken pure love for Krishna in our hearts, and then we'll be spontaneously attracted to go to Vrindavan and practice that same Raghunatha bhakti, or sit where we are now and practice that Raghunatha bhakti. It will come by the practice of sadhana bhakti. In the Raghunatha path, in the Rupa Nuga path, in the path of Rupa and Sanatana. We're practicing sadhana bhakti as described by Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasami Tasindhu. The same Rupa Goswami who himself acted like a avaduta, we're acting like brahmacharis and grihasthas, following in his footsteps, according to the sadhana bhakti that he taught us. Chant Hare Krishna, worship the deity, study Srimad Bhagavatam, associate with advanced devotees, and go to Krishna Mathura Mandala, Mayapur, Jagannath Puri. These five processes are recommended by Rupa Goswami among the 64 angas. These five angas have the potency to very quickly awaken love of God in our hearts. Even if we don't have strong faith in them, they're effective. That's Rupa Goswami's description. So that sadhana bhakti, especially emphasizing those five processes, we're following that in the footsteps of, following directly the instructions of Rupa Goswami. Sadhana bhakti, which we practice, you know, we're being told to practice in the roles of brahmacharis, grihasthas, and sannyasis. All five. Yeah. We should try to take at least one if we get all five. And, yes. 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 Okay, so we shouldn't complain. Yeah. Okay, I think we're out of time. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
So it's described. We'll read. Did anybody see whether the earlier in the day, whether the office had prepared the printouts of the verses? No? Okay. I sent someone downstairs to look and get them right now. And we're going to read, continuing from verse 12 of chapter 21 of the third canto. This is the beginning of, or just this is the verse just before Kardamar starts praying. He's looking at Lord Narayan standing in front of him. So verse 12 says, I'll read the Sanskrit. Jata harsho patanmurdna Shital labda manorataha girbis twabhyagrinat priti swabhavatma kritanjalihi. Can we get some more chairs next door? Is it, and maybe locked. The room may be locked. We'll bring some more chairs. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. When Kardama Muni actually realized the supreme personality and the supreme personality of Godhead in person, he was greatly satisfied because his transcendental desire was fulfilled. He fell on the ground with his head bowed to offer obeisances unto the lotus feet of the Lord. His heart naturally full of love of God, with folded hands, he satisfied the Lord with prayers.
This can be contrasted, say, with Daksha Prajapati, another Prajapati, colleague of Kardama, basically equals, but they don't have the same individual degree of devotion. Kardama is much greater devotee than Daksha. Daksha, the two of them both have the desire to beget children, material desire, but Daksha is much more materially contaminated by that desire. He's much farther from pure devotion. So Daksha Maharaj, he also, Daksha Prajapati, also offered prayers to Vishnu, also performed austerities and meditation. It's described in, fourth chapter, eighth canto, maybe. It's in the sixth canto somewhere. Daksha offers the Hamsaguya prayers in the Vedas. And Vishnu, again, just like here, appears to Daksha. But Daksha doesn't have a strongly developed devotional sentiment. He's still on the impersonal platform. When Vishnu appeared to Daksha, Daksha was stunned. Just the glaring effulgence and the brilliant appearance of the Lord. And he really didn't know how to react, how to deal with the Supreme Person. Here's God right in front of you. He came to you to respond to your prayers, and you don't know what to do. So Daksha fumbled and tried to say something, and he really wasn't able to have any proper personal reciprocation with Lord Vishnu because he lacked the devotion. He really didn't know how to deal personally with anybody, what to speak of God. His only idea of how to live life was to manipulate other people. And you can't manipulate the Supreme Person. He just won't become another object of your exploitation. So here's the difference. Kardama, because he has love in his heart, even if he has some material desire also, he's able to have a proper personal exchange with Lord Narayan. There's a very fruitful exchange. So, full of ecstasy and love, Kardama is now going to offer his prayers. I'll stop for, if anybody has any comments or questions, I'll stop for a few minutes for that. But let's try to keep it on track. Try to keep the discussion to the topic if possible. Does anybody have anything to ask or comment on? Yes, ma'am. Yes, I mean, how much we can take proper advantage of the opportunity to associate with Vaishnavas depends on our devotional attitude. If we don't give up our materialistic habits of thinking and behaving, if we don't stop acting like barbarians and we don't become civilized, then we're going to fail to be able to properly have it.
Learning how to love by practicing with one another. Rupa Goswami discusses all these things in both Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhura and his Upadeshamrita, his short book. We're supposed to practice loving exchanges in our dealings with other Vaishnavas. In the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, King Nimi is getting instructions from the 9 Yogendras, sons of Rishabhdev. I don't remember which of the 9, but he gave instruction to Nimi about what characterizes a mature devotee. Paramahamsa is one thing. He discusses in detail the qualities of a Paramahamsa. But he also distinguishes what's an intermediate class devotee, Madhyama Adhikari, Madhyama Bhakta, and what's a Kanishtha Bhakta, a materialistic devotee. So in describing the characteristics, defining the intermediate devotee, mature but not perfect devotee, he says, he makes the definition in terms of how that devotee behaves.
You know, what's going on in his heart? That's a little more hard, especially for ordinary people, to ascertain what's going on in anybody's heart. But you can judge from the external behavior. So he says, Ishware tadadineshu balisheshu dvishatshu cha prema maitri kripo peksha yak karoti samajamaha. This is definition characteristics of a middle class devotee. That he makes practical distinctions. He deals differently with four different classes of persons. Ishvara, the Lord himself. And we can consider the spiritual master as direct representative of the Supreme Lord. And in the second category, tadadineshu, those who are submissive to the Lord, the devotees, the Vaishnavas. Third class of people are those who are not submissive, but they're not envious. They're just foolish, balisheshu, childish. The mass, the general mass, the vast majority of the population, who are just silly. So, and then the last class of people are those who are actually envious of God, hateful of God and his devotees. Prema maitri kripa upeksha, kripa upeksha. For the Supreme Lord, a mature, middle-class devotee should try to love God unconditionally. Whatever happens in your life, you should accept it as God's mercy and try to love him. And the same attitude should be there for the spiritual master. For all the devotees who are the submissive servants of the Lord, one should try to develop friendship, maitri. Toward the innocent, one should try to be compassionate by giving them Krishna consciousness. And the envious, one should avoid. So this is a functional, practical definition of how you can judge who's a fixed-up middle-class devotee. The point there is that, the relevant point is that one should try to be friends with all the devotees. This requires becoming personal. You can't develop any kind of spiritual friendship with anybody if you're still treating them like a thing rather than a person. You know, an object of pure exploitation, gratification. We have a great tendency in material life to judge other people according to what they do to us. Because this person isn't giving me what I want, therefore he's bad. He's a useless person. And we're always making these judgments based on how people treat us. Which is not really very intelligent. So, to come up to that high standard of becoming the friend of all the Vaishnavas requires a lot of maturity and becoming actually learning how to become personal, actually. So, yes, it's very relevant. Daksha, someone like Daksha, too materialistic. Therefore, he can't practice proper devotional service even when Vishnu's comes to him personally, he can't reciprocate. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained, Raghunath Das. This is not that discussion. But anyway, the instruction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is that there are two classes of men who can't be devotees of Krishna. The atheist, of course, is one. The other one is those who are simply too materialistic, too attached to sense gratification. That makes it almost impossible for them to manifest, to develop any pure devotion to Krishna. Anyway, Kardama Muni is minimally materialistic. He's got some material desire, but he's got a lot of devotion. So that 99.9% of devotion balanced against the 0.1% of materialism, that's going to save him. He'll attain perfection very easily. Okay? So, we can move on. As soon as we start reading the prayer that Kardama offers here. So everyone has the text now? We're looking at verse 13 of the first chapter, chapter 21. I'll read the Sanskrit. Vishiruvacha Jushtam Bhatadya Kila Satvarashe
samsidhyam akshnos tava darshananna yad darshanam janmabir idya sadbir ashasate yogino rudha yoga. So I think you have everything that the first entrance and purport is there. So the homework assignment is to go ahead and read, say, up to the end of the prayers for tomorrow. And read Prabhupada's purports also. In our discussion, we'll be touching on some of the points. We won't have enough time to cover the purports thoroughly, but we'll discuss some of the things that Prabhupada says in his purport. So the translation of this verse. The great sage Kardama said, O supreme worshipful Lord, my power of sight is now fulfilled, having attained the great perfection of the sight of you, who are the reservoir of all existences. Through many successive births of deep meditation, advanced yogis aspire to see your transcendental form. So it's a great embarrassment to know that you're God's servant and to have a strong desire to regain your position in the eternal service of Krishna. At the same time, have material desires that are blocking that. Very embarrassing for a devotee. And then it's very satisfying that the Lord will accept you anyway. Don't come to you. You don't know where to find him. But in response to your attempts at devotion, Krishna comes to you. Then that's very satisfying, very gratifying. So Kardama is feeling that great gratification. He's very thankful to Lord Vishnu. Despite all his disqualifications, Vishnu is agreeing to reciprocate with him. He says that see Vishnu is the aspiration of all the yogis. Of course, there are other kinds of yogis. They are practicing what they think is yoga, discipline to achieve liberation or some other idea of perfection. But many of them don't, at least consciously, recognize that the goal of that discipline, that meditation, is to reestablish one's connection with God. Yoga means connection. The verb yuj in Sanskrit means to join. So if you, say, take an ox and yoke it to a cart, that's called yujade. The ox is connected by the yoke. And the English word yoke is the same word, coming from yuj. So anything is attached or connected. That's the meaning of the word yuj. Yoga is simply the noun that comes from that verb. Connection is the meaning of the word yoga. But what are we actually talking about? What is real yoga? What is the purpose of the yoga that's taught in the Upanishads and the Shastras? It's to connect. What, yeah, the jiva, what is he supposed to be connected? Ox, you're supposed to connect to the cart and let him plow the field. That's the purpose of his connection. What about the jiva? What is he supposed to be connected to? So, as again explained by Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya's teachings, jivaya swarup hoy Krishna nichodash. The eternal quality of the self, inseparable, functional quality of the spirit soul, is that he's eternally Krishna's servant. So taking that into account, that's the essence, essential purpose and identity of the jiva. He's supposed to be serving Krishna. Just like the ox is supposed to be plowing the field. You're not going to be able to get him to do that until you yoke him to the plow. So the jiva is supposed to be serving Krishna, but he's loitering in the material world. He has to be reconnected. And that's the purpose, that's the meaning of the whole idea of yoga. to reconnect the jiva to the service, to the eternal service, loving service of the Supreme Person. That's the purpose of yoga. Some people who call themselves yogis don't understand that. They have some other idea what they think they're connecting to. But that's what a real yogi is. Therefore, Kardama says here, yad darshanam janmanir janmabir idya. Oh, idya. I'm looking at the third line here of the verse. Idya. Oh, you who are meant to be worshipped. People may worship various demigods or worship ordinary people, but you're the one who's actually supposed to be worshipped. So, oh, proper object of everybody's worship. The yogis, yogino, plural, those who are actually practicing the discipline of reconnecting with the Supreme, they're trying and aspiring janmabihi for many lifetimes. Yad darshanam, just to see you. The perfection of meditational yoga is to see Paramatma in the heart. This doesn't even have a, there's not even a conception of going beyond that to have any reciprocation, any loving dealing with Paramatma. Just try to come to the point, minimal point of just seeing it. That's the goal of meditational yoga. And the yogis may have to spend many lifetimes coming, striving to reach that point of Paramatma realization. So Kardama, he knows about this, although he's living at the practically at the beginning of Brahma's day. I don't know how many people have, how many lifetimes anybody has passed that early in Brahma's day. But he's aware of the past history of the human race, how even in previous kalpas, yogis used to meditate for many, many lifetimes, just to get to see, get a glimpse of the Paramatma. In this way, Kardama is expressing his great gratitude. You know, I don't know what I deserve, how I deserve this. Yogis who are much more adept than me try for lifetimes to get your vision, and here you are. You've appeared before me in person, not just some image in the heart, but you're standing in front of me, in front of my eyes. I don't know what I did to deserve this. He's also a yogi. Krishna says, yogi nam api sarve sham madgatin antaratmana shradhavan bhajate yo mam samayuktatam omata. At the end of the sixth chapter, last verse, Krishna of the Gita, Krishna says, the best yogi of all the different kinds of yogis and different qualities of yogis, the best one is the one who has complete faith in me, who trusts that I will give him complete protection and provide everything he needs, and worships me, even putting aside and ignoring everything else, and simply worships me, and thinks of me all the time. He's the best yogi. That's pure devotee. So Kardama, he knows he's not a pure devotee. He considers that his desire, material desire, disqualifies him from being considered a pure devotee. Still, he's a yogi. If we want to categorize him technically, we could call him a kind of karma yogi. He's practicing karma mishra bhakti. Generally, the demigods are practicing karma mishra bhakti. To be posted as a demigod, you have to be a servant, or a competent, or a trustworthy servant of the Supreme Lord. Just like there are big corporations, they hire. I worked for AT&T for some months, American, the biggest, one of the biggest corporations in the world. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people they employ all over the world. Probably half a million people. So they employ a lot of people, pay them $5 or $7 an hour just to do some clerical work or work in the warehouse.
they don't have to be very trustworthy, but to become an officer in the corporation, you know, make a lot of money and have a big responsibility, you have to be trustworthy. They're not going to, unless they don't know how to run their company, they're not going to put you in a very responsible position unless you're trustworthy. So to become a demigod, to be given control over some department of creation, over all the living entities in the universe, there are many different demigods and they each have different responsibilities. Some demigod is in charge of the little pinky. It doesn't move unless that demigod sanctions it. And every pinky in the universe, every little finger, is controlled by that particular demigod. That's very powerful. That's a lot of responsibility, a lot of power. The Supreme Lord is not going to, and his agents, the material energy, are not going to let anybody get that responsibility, that power, unless they are trustworthy enough to handle it, to actually execute responsibly, competently, Krishna's service. So demigods are good devotees. They're trustworthy. They can be trusted to do the job. Still they have material desires. Up to Lord Brahma. They have desires, and that's why they take these positions of control. They want to enjoy control. They want to be dominating everyone else. So they're called Sakama Bhaktas. Mixed devotional service. And what the mixture is in their case is karmic desire. Desire to be successful, to get a high position in the material world. That's karma desire. So they're karma Mishra Bhaktas. On the other hand, sages who are meditating, jnanis, yogis, who are practicing meditation or study of philosophy for the purpose of getting liberation for themselves. That's called Jnana Mishra Bhakti. And you can also maybe distinguish Yoga Mishra Bhakti. So two or three different kinds of mixed devotional service. Kardama is in the category, he's a meditator, but he's meditating in order to get some material benefit. He wants a wife, and then get some children, and carry out the order of Brahma. That's Karma Mishra Bhakti. Even that karma mishra bhakti can lead to perfection. That's why Krishna recommends it. We were discussing yesterday. Krishna describes, first recommendation, just think about me all the time. Spontaneous loving attraction. Just practice that. If you can't do that, if you just can't muster the pure devotion and avoid all distractions, if you have too many material desires, okay, practice sadhana bhakti. Follow the rules and regulations. Accept as a matter of duty and responsibility that I have to obey the injunctions of my guru out of Shastra. Serve Krishna out of duty. That's what we're trying to do. Practice sadhana bhakti. That's what ISKCON is established for. Raghunuga bhakti is there, but Prabhupada did not talk too much about us engaging in Raghunuga Bhakti at this point. That's when we become purified enough, then we can start Raghunuga Bhakti. Mostly in ISKCON, we're practicing Sadhana Bhakti. But that means we're supposed to follow, you know, live up to the standard, follow regulative principles, chant our rounds, and do other things according to rules and regulations. But there are many people who can't do that. We've seen so many of our own God brothers and God sisters, even leaders of our society, who couldn't maintain the standard and went away. And there are many other people in the world who are attracted but can't join us in the full sense. They can't follow our regular principles. It's too much for them. They'd like to be devotees, but they can't live up to the standard. So what do you do with these people? Krishna gives his third recommendation. Okay, if you can't even practice sadhana bhakti, then do what you're going to do, but offer the results to me. And the Varnashram system is established in order to to facilitate that endeavor of doing your work and offering the result to Vishnu as an act of sacrifice. Vedic system, the social aspect of the Vedic system is the Varnashram organization. But Vedas also are based on the process of offering sacrifice to the Supreme Lord. Varnashram system is there. The Brahmins are there. Their first business is to perform sacrifice, to worship God. And they organize the rest of society to participate in that sacrifice. The kings sponsor the sacrifices, the Brahmins are the priests, and the Vaishyas provide the material goods needed for the performance of sacrifice, and the Shudras do their work to perform the sacrifice. The potters and the carpenters, they also participate in the sacrifice. Under the organization of the under the direction of the Brahmins and the protection of the Kshatriyas. This is the Vedic system. It's centered around worshipping God, but indirectly, not spontaneous Raganuga Bhakti, not even strict regulations of sadhana bhakti, not up to that standard either. It's the third rank, third level of the way to worship God. Karmakanda, we call it karma yoga. Performing sacrifice and channeling the results to the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. The participants of the Varnashram system in all the four Varnas are each in their own way joining in the performance of sacrifice. They have material desires, but it's being channeled to the pleasure of the Supreme Lord by the performance of sacrifice. And then there's the performance of yoga by those who are very gyanis and the yogis. Okay, do we have any comments or questions at this point? Yes. 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 I'm sorry, how do you describe it? Someone has material desires. Yes. 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 That, it's on that level of consciousness. They're not the consciousness of a spontaneous loving devotee, not even on the level of consciousness of a practicing, you know, sadhaka bhakta, but what we call a karmi, someone who accepts the authority of the Vedas and helps in the performance of sacrifice. Even a Shudra, he accepts the authority of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, and he does his duty following the guidance they give him. He's also participating in sacrifice. So, yes, Oh, yes. Yeah, just like Krishna said, Mami Chaptum. Perform sadhana bhakti because that will awaken the desire to spontaneously serve me. So, also on this third level, by offering the results of your work to the Supreme Lord, that will purify. What does he say there? Your life will become perfect if you offer the fruits of your work to me. That's described by so many places. Ramanujacharya in his Vedanta Sutra commentary explains, Atato Brahmika Gyasa, now we should inquire into the absolute truth. But what does that now mean? Now when? So he explains, after we perform the Vedic sacrifices, that purifies our heart, and then we can think about inquiring into the absolute truth. So the performance of karma, of Vedic ritual, sacrifice, purifies your heart, so that knowledge, spiritual knowledge, can begin to develop in it. When our hearts are too full of contamination, envy, greed, lust, we can't have any spiritual intelligence. But when we become purified by performing service to God, indirectly through the sacrifice, without devotion, but we're doing our sacrifice, even with material motives, that purifies our heart enough that spiritual understanding starts to develop. Yes?
That's pure vritti marga. You know, nivritti marga is the path of renunciation. That's practiced by the philosophers, the jnanis, by the yogis, and by the bhaktas. That's nivritti marga. Pravritti marga is the path of karmakanda, of ritualistic sacrifice. Or people who don't even live up to that standard, they don't even perform sacrifice, they just live like cats and dogs. That's the lower end of pravritti marga. So Manu says, here's my Manu Samhita, this is my instructions for mankind. But pravittyodesha bhutanam, all these things I'm giving instruction on, this is pravritti marga. This is just the harnessing the materialistic propensities that everybody has. So everybody has these materialistic propensities. Nivrittis tu mahapala. But I recommend that if you can put aside all this materialism and take to the nivritti marga, then you'll get the best benefit. So that's Manu himself, and the Manu Samhita is recommending that. Okay, pravritti marga is there because most people have a lot of material desires. But best you can, if you can rise above this and come to the point of transcendental knowledge and or beyond that to devotion. I'll get to you. Yes? Well, yes. Huge also means to use. Beside connect, another meaning is, especially when you add the prefix pra to it. Pra-yuge. Yuge means just to connect. But pra-yuge has a, when you add a prefix like that, it often changes the meaning. So the meaning of pra-yuge is to utilize, to use. Prayojana, in the general sense, means the use of something. What's the prayojana of this thing? It's a tape recorder. It's meant for recording voices. That's the prayojana of this plastic machine. The prayojanam of human life is to reciprocate with God in a loving relationship. That's the real prayojanam, is love of God, of the jiva. But it's connected, it's the same root, but when you add that prefix, the meaning changes. Okay. Yes, please. Need? Yeah, in Sanskrit, the word ends up meaning, in the noun, means purpose of something. So yeah, why do you do this? What are you trying to accomplish by it? So and then I guess when it used in the popular language Bengali, then the meaning shifts a little bit, and it means desire, need. But in Sanskrit, more properly, it means purpose. Yeah.
You said that Dasha was much less of a listening group as
a I think we can say that, yeah.
But still, according to this thinking and effect, so many steps and words of interpretation have been so gained from this time to see your passing before.
Yes.
So Dasha.
Okay.
Yes. So
yes.
Okay,
you got me there. Daksha, we can't take too much liberty in criticizing Daksha. He did get to see Vishnu. He is an empowered personality, engaged in the service of the Supreme Lord. He's popular, helping to populate the universe. Maybe we can just say it's his pastime. And he's got all these material desires, and he's ends up cursing Narada when he gets into trouble. Yeah. And he did fail to take full advantage of the opportunity, of meeting Lord Vishnu and having some exchange with him. He couldn't take proper advantage of it. It's like some of the devotees in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, like we mentioned in class this morning at Ramachandra Puri. But actually he's an eternal associate of Krishna. Who is he? In Krishna, but in Krishna's yes. Anyway, he's one of maybe. He's one of the eternal associates of Radha Krishna in Vrajadam. Yeah, he's not a materialistic person.
But he just, you know, he was put in this pastime where he's, you know, committing aparads and doing stuff. You know, everybody wants to get rid of him. You know, it's just a pastime. So the same thing with Daksha. You know, maybe deep in his heart he's a very great devotee, but he's not showing it. It's not that we have to be free from material desires before. That's not, you know, Rupa Goswami describes this in an early chapter of Nectar of Devotion. What's the minimum qualification for beginning pure devotional service? Not mixed devotional service, like practiced by the demigods and someone like Kartama, but pure devotional service. You have to actually decide that you want to dedicate your life to Krishna. And you have to be able to follow the rules, you know, the rules, instructions of a pure devotee, submit to his guidance. Krishna explains in his instructions to Uddhava, tavat karmani kurvita nanyavidyate yavata matkata shravana adau cha yavan shvadhana jayate. You'll have to go on performing karma, you know, your karmakanda activities, until you become disgusted with them. As long as you still want to be a materialist, no sense trying to stop artificially. But then he makes more essential point. Until you develop attraction to hearing and chanting about me, much kata shravanato, hearing and so on, hearing, chanting, remembering the topics of my glories, until you get a taste for Krishna kata, you're going to have to go on with your karma. When you become attracted to Krishna Katha, then you can drop it. So that's the, really the basic qualification, is attraction to hearing and chanting about Krishna. If you don't have that attraction, then you're not ready for pure devotional service. Yes. Yeah, Rupa Goswami he discusses that those who won't come to the point of practicing pure devotional service, no matter what they're doing that's auspicious, they won't become actually happy, they won't become free from anxiety. Yeah. All these benefits they won't gain them until they come to the point of pure devotional service. So, if someone teaches you this philosophy, and you can understand even theoretically, hey look, my life is wasted if I don't somehow or other surrender to Krishna. By theoretical understanding, one can force himself to surrender. So it's very beneficial to study the philosophy, even if you don't have attraction to hearing and chanting. Anyway, that's the purpose of preaching. To approach people who are ignorant but innocent, give them some good advice, and by our personal association, which is, my association is not worth much, but at least by my association, someone may get Prabhupada's association. So we're giving the association with pure devotee to ourselves. That and the advice of the Shastra, that can change a person's life. When ISKCON was becoming active in the Soviet Union, there was one big poster, beautiful poster from the cover of the Russian Nectar of Devotion has a nice picture of Krishna playing the flute. And so big poster that was there in the Moscow subway and all over the place. These books can change your life. So for different national mentalities, there's different things that appeal. If you told Americans this could change your life, they say, I don't want to change my life. But if you tell the people in the communist countries, we want to change our lives. So it's an attractive idea that this knowledge can change your life. If a person wants to change his life, and he gets the association of a pure devotee who's ready to give him, or a representative of a devotee who's ready to give him that knowledge, then he's very fortunate. Then his life can become perfect. by hearing from devotees, especially if we're ready to accept their instructions, we can be pulled up by the bootstraps. Even if we're not qualified, we can be very quickly jump up to that qualification and get an attraction for hearing and chanting. And that's the basic qualification for pure devotional service. So Prabhupada came to this world, and he came to the Western countries, and by his personal association and his powerful instructions, he pulled us out of material entanglement by making us attracted to hear and chant about Krishna. Anyway, that was it's not exactly on the topic because this, you know, Kardam is not at that point yet. Yeah.
You mentioned if you cannot even do sadhana, Krishna awakenings, you would want to do the channel the results of mind satisfaction.
Yes.
What about what category does this mean where the body wants to do a particular type of service? Maybe open a restaurant or something like that. Maybe even
just do some business. Yes.
So it's kind of like what he wants to do.
Yes.
So another
type,
another
thing
we
could have
is
service. Well, if it's really not a matter of what the activity is, opening a restaurant or selling books. A book can be a prasadam restaurant. You know, generally is a very auspicious activity. Or selling Prabhupada's books is, you know, supposed to be absolutely auspicious. But it depends how you do it. If you do it, even those activities whimsically, you know, you could go out and you know, beat people up and steal the money from their wallets and, you know, leave them with a book. That's criminal. You know, you can distribute Prabhupada's books in such a way that it is not auspicious. Or you could open a prasadam restaurant, you know, that's not properly run, or you're selling wine in the restaurant, and this even happened in America, one so-called Govinda's restaurant. If the activity is done whimsically, not under proper guidance, then it's not auspicious. So it's not so much what you're doing, but whether you're accepting spiritual guidance. If we go to our spiritual master and say, Guruji, I'd like to open a restaurant. Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think I can do it? Do you think it'll be successful? And you take his guidance, and he says, yes, go ahead, you know, you can do it. Or he says, no, forget it, you're not confident. By the sanction of the spiritual master, it becomes transcendental. It becomes pure devotional service. That's what we have spiritual masters for. On the lower level, in the Varnashram system, we have our prescribed activities. You know, we're in a certain Varna and a certain ashram. And according to what class we belong to in the Varna and the Ashram system, there are certain things we're supposed to do and other things we're not supposed to do. And then we also go, kings go to the Brahmins for advice, the Vaishyas go to their Panditjis for advice, the Shudras have their masters, and everybody has somebody to go to get guidance from in the Varnashram system also. Civilized life means to accept some higher authority, not to make up your own mind about everything. You know, but we come from modern civilization where we're taught to distrust authority, make up our own minds about everything. This is barbarian. And we're not even, you know, say, I can't make it as a Brahmin, I want to be a Shudra. If you want to be a Shudra, you have to be obedient to somebody. A Shudra has that qualification that he's obedient, he listens. If you're not willing to listen to anybody, you're not even you can't even be a Shudra. And Brahmins are not like that. Brahmins are the most obedient. They follow the Shastra strictly about everything. Okay. Maybe we'll move on to the next verse. Text 14.
Ye mayaya te hatameda sastvat padara vindam bhava sindhu potam upasate kamalavaya te sham rasisha kama niraye piye syuhu.
Translation. Your lotus feet are the true vessel to take one across the ocean of material nescience. Only persons deprived of their intelligence by the spell of the deluding energy, will worship those feet with a view to attain the trivial and momentary pleasures of the senses, which even persons rotting in hell can attain. However, O my Lord, you are so kind that you bestow mercy even upon them. So Kardama is not just, you know, pointing a finger at everyone else. He's talking about himself here. He's actually being very humble and honest. I'm sorry. I'm also one of these materialistic persons. You're so kind that you're willing to give us what we want. Because he says in the next verse, Tatacha Sachaham, you know, I'm also like that. He'll admit that in the very next shloka. So he's putting himself, he's designating himself as a Sakama Bhakta. Here I am, I'm your devotee. I want to make my whole life dedicated to your service. But I'm sorry, I've got some really very stubborn material desires. I can't just put them aside. And I know, I admit, that those fools like myself who worship you for kama lava, lava is a little drop of water, so for a few specks of sense gratification, it's foolish enough to have such desires, but then to go to God and waste his time begging for sense gratification, oh God, give us our daily bread. As if God has no better thing to do but to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and bake bread for everybody. So it's very foolish to approach, to worship God for the fulfillment of very petty sense desires. But that's the position of almost everybody in the material world, including the powerful demigods and even the great sages, even the sons of Brahma. They're hampered by these material desires, which leave them in a very embarrassing position, especially when the Supreme Lord comes to reciprocate with them. You're there with your material desires on your, you know, greasy hands covered with material desires, and you have to admit to the Supreme Lord, I'm sorry, I've got these desires. So this is the position of demigods, sages, karmis. Now, Prabhupada use the word karmi to mean all the non-devotees. Now, there's people out in the street, they're karmis. If you go out, sell books to the karmis. Shout out to the karmis. That's really a very euphemistic use of the word. He's actually being very generous and kind. Because properly speaking, the word karmi traditionally means those who perform karma. And karma doesn't just mean any materialistic work, it means Vedic sacrifice. So the pious Brahmins and the other members of the Varnashram system who are engaged in Vedic sacrifice, they're karmis. The people on the streets of the modern world, you know, to call them karmis is a very kind act of generosity. To call them karmis, it's a euphemism. They're not real karmis. They're not up to the standard. But the Vedic karmis and the demigods and sages are higher than them. And the persons who are gyanis, or they want to worship God, but they also want liberation. They have a motivation. They're worshiping God with a material motivation of liberation. So they're Jnana Mishra devotees. They're in that position of being Sakama. They've got devotion, but that devotion is tainted by material desire. Also in the modern world, we've got such devotees. We don't have to go up to Swarga Loka to find Sakama Bhaktas. We're very fortunate. We've been introduced by the mercy of Prabhupada and his predecessors acting through him into the path of pure devotional service under the auspices of Rupa Goswami. But there are many other Vaishnavas in this world. In Kali Yuga there are many Vaishnavas, there are four Sampradayas. But those who don't have the fortune to recognize the absolute position of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even though they're practicing the worship of Krishna, their devotion can't be anything more than mixed devotion. So devotees, not to offend anybody, but devotees in the other sampradayas who don't recognize that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, not to speak of recognizing that he's Krishna in the mood of Radha,
But at least if they don't recognize that Lord Chaitanya is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then they cannot come to the standard in this life of pure devotion. Their devotion is going to be mixed with material motives. And we see this in the other sampradayas. Anybody who is associated with the Vaishnavas in the other orthodox sampradayas, their devotion is mixed. They've got a lot of material desires. And then also, in the category of Sakama Bhaktas, we can see in modern times, there are those who are trying to be followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.